This time on your weekly Constitutional, author David O. Stewart talks about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson.
And some of it was that he was a jerk, but some of it also was essentially that he was defeating the will of the nation.
Impeachment, whether of Andrew Johnson or of Bill Clinton, might seem a historical issue to you, and indeed it is. But of course, it's been very much in the air these days. And so after we talk about Andrew Johnson, and after David tells us about his own experience defending the impeachment of a federal judge, we'll ask him whether he thinks our current president might be subject to the same penalty. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional. And this week, it's about David O. Stewart and his book, Impeached.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Impeachment is a subject that's very much in the air these days. Whether you're a supporter of our current president or an opponent, you can't deny the fact that he's done some very controversial things and that some of those things, according to some of his opponents, may actually constitute impeachable offenses. Is that a realistic possibility? Well, we've decided to go right to the expert. David O. Stewart, a constitutional lawyer, an author, historian, is the author of, among other things, a book called Impeached. And this book was recently identified in the Wall Street Journal as the very best book on the subject of impeachment. So today, David's going to tell us all about it. David Stewart, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. It's been far, far too long. And you have been in the news recently. You have been in the Wall Street Journal. Tell me about that.
Well, they did a feature on the best books about impeachment. For some reason, they thought that was timely. And they were kind enough to list my book, Impeached, about the impeachment trial of Andrew Johnson. Indeed, they even listed it number one.
It was the number one book. So anybody who wants to go out and read about impeachment is advised by the Wall Street Journal to go and get your book. And, of course, I hope people will do that. And then it's available on Amazon. It was published back in 2009, right?
Correct.
Okay. And at your local bookstore, I hope they've still got a few copies in stock as well. But what's really interesting to me, and this is something you and I have discussed in the past, is that you have, if not a unique inspiration for having written that book, a very unusual one, because you're one of the few lawyers, in fact, you may be the only lawyer I personally know, who's actually defended an impeachment trial in the United States Senate.
It was an unusual opportunity, experience. I defended a federal judge from South Mississippi, Walter Nixon. When he was subject to impeachment, he had run afoul of a grand jury in Mississippi and been convicted of perjury and was, sad to say, residing in the federal penitentiary at the time of the Senate trial,
which
made the trial a bit of an uphill slog.
But before we do that, let's lay the groundwork here. Federal judges often are said casually to have lifetime tenure, that they get to stay in their jobs forever. And for most of them, that's true. But what Article 3 of the Constitution actually says is that they stay there for good behavior. So if you want to get rid of a federal judge, you essentially have to impeach him. The House of Representatives has to vote articles of impeachment, and then there's a trial in the Senate, correct?
That is correct.
Okay, and I'm just curious. Go ahead.
Removed about a half dozen judges that way. About a dozen judges that way.
Yeah, which is really interesting. I don't think that's common knowledge. We think of impeachment, we think of presidents. We think of Bill Clinton, for example. Or perhaps for the historically minded, they'll think of Andrew Johnson, who was the subject of your book. But they won't think of federal judges being impeached, and yet it has happened quite a number of times over the years. But before we even get to that part of it, I'm just curious, why would Walter Nixon, this federal judge sitting in prison, convicted of perjury, still a federal judge, though, why would he call David Stewart, other than the fact that you're just a really cool guy and an amazing lawyer? What connection did you have with him?
We would have to call those reasons one and two, of course, but there was a third reason, which was that he tried to hire my partner, and my partner was busy and was kind enough to say, well, this guy Stewart's pretty good.
Your partner was too busy to defend a federal impeachment trial. He turned down a trial in the United States Senate. He must have been busy indeed.
Yeah, well, it was only at a, this is dreary stuff. It was on a petition for rehearing en banc in the Court of Appeals, and it was not a very sexy matter. So I was willing to take it on, and then it morphed into an impeachment.
That is just remarkable. Okay, so you get the call. Walter Nixon, federal judge, jailbird, down in federal prison.
Wait, come on. Lighten up.
You're the one who was saying it was a tough case. So you've got a guy in jail.
Let's keep a little respect in the conversation.
Sorry. This is a very important case. In fact, United States versus Nixon, as we shall see, went all the way to the Supreme Court. But you get a call, and you have to go and defend this case. And so what happened at that point? I mean, how does the United States Senate actually try an impeachment?
Well, the House brings the indictment, which they call the Articles of Impeachment. And that was a long process in our case because the House actually was uncertain. The key guys in the House were uncertain, but they did go forward. The Senate these days, and actually since the 70s, has followed an unusual procedure where only 12 of the senators hear the evidence. The other 88 senators are supposed to absorb the evidence by reading a report from the other senators or watching it on video or, you know, just being so cool that they know the facts. And then they all get together and hear a closing argument on the floor of the Senate, which I did deliver. And then they vote after discussing it in executive session. So it's not a standard trial in any respect, frankly, because, you know, you don't – when I was questioning witnesses, you know, I was basically doing it in front of 12 guys and a camera. And most of the people who were going to vote on the case didn't hear any of that. That we challenged that. That's what went to the Supreme Court, that procedure was simply unfair to have a jury with 88 members who didn't know the facts. And the Supreme Court basically ruled that we should just go home. This was a political question. The Senate can try an impeachment however it wishes, and the courts will not intrude. So that is the procedure. And it's interesting. Let me just move on for one second. When you look at the Clinton impeachment trial, they didn't apply that rule, but both sides pretty much agreed they didn't want to have any testimony before the full Senate. So they took a little testimony and depositions off in conference rooms, and then they went straight to closing argument.
But once again, the Senate, which is the finder of fact, which is ultimately going to vote on the guilt or innocence or whether a person should be removed from office or not, basically gets to set its own rules, and it can hear evidence live if it wants to. It can hear it via depositions if it wants to. It can have all 100 senators there if they want to be, or it can have a subcommittee or a committee of 12 of them hearing it on behalf of all the remaining ones. That is remarkable that the Senate has that much power. Does that just emanate straight from its Article I power to set its own rules?
It does now. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it should. But, you know, the motivation behind it, and I shouldn't be too unfair about it, was they were having these trials back in 1920 and 1910 and 1930 of federal judges on the floor of the Senate, and no senators were watching.
Nobody?
So,
wow.
Yeah, basically, like two or three would show up. And that was found to be embarrassing.
It's understandable in one sense. I mean, if you watch C-SPAN, if you just simply visit the United States Senate, that's not unusual. I mean, the senators are not actually on the floor of the Senate, except when they themselves are speaking or if they've got some colloquy they want to go and enter into the record. So the Senate was
That's exactly right. And, you know, for hundreds of years, one of the principal qualities of a senator has been an unwillingness to listen to other people.
But that's one thing in a political context where most of the business is happening in, you know, smoke-filled room somewhere or in a committee room or in someone's office. That's one thing. But they were applying that same work ethic or that same approach to their work in a circumstance where they were supposed to be sitting as a jury. And that was the essential problem that you were confronting in your case, was that this just ain't fair. If the senators are doing something special here, then it ain't fair to allow them to treat this as lackadaisically as perhaps they treat a political debate.
Yeah, well, shut my mouth. that's what these people do. So, and they retain now and have full power to hear the case however they choose to, particularly if they choose not to hear it.
That is just remarkable. But you also mentioned something else that might be a little bit unfamiliar to people, and that's the so-called political question doctrine. Now, I'm going to state it how I understand it, and then you tell me if I got it right. Sometimes the court, the United States Supreme Court, will simply say, we're not going to hear this case. We're going to say that it's not justiciable, which is a fancy word for saying we're not going to hear this case. And they can do it under a variety of rationales. And one of them is to simply say this is a question that's best left to the so-called political branches of the national government, to the Congress itself, or to the president. It's simply not something that we as judges are going to touch. And if I recall correctly from their opinion in the Nixon case, this was particularly true because they would, if they'd reversed this, they would have been effectively checking a check on the judiciary. They would have been reversing a removal of one of their own. Was that why ultimately they declared this to be a political question?
Yes, I think they, one of the things judges do is they think about, so I'm going to write an order with my decision in it, who am I ordering to do what? And I think judges were not comfortable writing an order that told the U.S. Senate that they had to have another trial.
Yeah.
And that they had to do it another way. I just think that felt like trenching on the separation of powers between the branches of government that they shouldn't be doing. We, of course, had some very clever and proper ways they could have written their order, but plainly we did not persuade them.
Well, before we leave the subject, what were some of the clever and proper ways they could have done that? Because, again, I think before I give you a chance to answer that question, I'm going to state that I think my impression is they got that part of the decision right, that the political question doctrine decision probably was an appropriate exercise of judicial restraint, because they didn't want to. That was my impression. You can persuade me otherwise. I'm much more sympathetic to your argument that the Senate was misbehaving, and that if they'd actually reached that that ultimate question, that the Senate should have been held to a higher standard when it was engaging in the impeachment process. But what's your argument then? How could they have avoided that political question problem? How could they have ordered the United States Senate to do something and actually expected the Senate to have done it?
Well, I'm resurrecting a 28-year-old argument, but the fact is that the Senate is charged with trying impeachments, and trying a case means something. It doesn't mean having the option of reading a report that you may or may not read, or watching a video that you may or may not read. When they wrote the Constitution, trying a case meant you sit there and you listen to the evidence. So this is not a discretionary decision. And we knew, or thought we knew, from a previous case involving Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, that when the Senate and Congress had a non-discretionary duty, a duty that they had to perform, that was something the courts would decide. And before our case was heard, I predicted that if Powell versus McCormick, which is the Adam Clayton Powell case, was still good law, that we would win. And if the court was willing to abandon Powell versus McCormick, that we would lose. And the court, in effect, abandoned the Powell ruling. That involved the unseating of a congressman. And the Supreme Court in that case had ordered that he be reseated. That could not be a more political question by any decision. But they said, well, this had to do with his qualifications. It wasn't something they had any discretion on. Therefore, they had to do it. Well, I thought they had a similar lack of discretion as to whether they would try a case.
Now, the Adam Clayton Powell case was interesting because Powell had supposedly engaged in some nefarious activities during his election campaign. And his colleagues in the House of Representatives simply made him step aside, literally the day he was to be sworn in. They had him step aside and they refused to swear him in on that basis. And then they saying he was unqualified to sit in the House of Representatives. But then the Supreme Court went back and looked at Article 1 and said that, no, there are several very specific requirements. You have to be 25 years old. You have to be a resident of the state wherein the district is located, et cetera, et cetera. And those are the only things that the U.S. House of Representatives can determine. Is this guy actually old enough? Does this guy actually reside in the state? So they were reading those provisions of Article 1 as being very narrow bases for the House to act. But you're correct that ultimately they were willing to then order the House to seat him.
Exactly.
And that was a very significant precedent on your side. But your contention is now that they effectively abandoned that by refusing to hear your case.
If I had a client come to me with this kind of problem, I would say Powell is no longer good law.
And you don't think it was the difference between the very specific requirements for House eligibility on the one hand in the Powell case and the more general grant of power for the Senate to set its own rules in your case?
I don't, because in the Powell case, they had to decide that he'd actually been elected. And that is something that is confided to the House. And they can't seat him if they haven't decided that he's been elected. And that's certainly no less discretionary than deciding that they need to hear the evidence in the trial in a case where they have to try an impeachment.
Golly, I got to have you come and talk to my class sometime, because I had not – no, seriously, I had not thought about those distinctions as deeply as you've just related to me. And I think
– you know what happens is – when you lose the case, nobody notices your reasoning.
Nobody reads the losing side's briefs.
You got to go back to my briefs to find any of this.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is David O. Stewart, a constitutional lawyer and author, historian, who's written a widely praised book called Impeached, all about, impeachment. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll speak some more with David O. Stewart. Stick around. It's constitutional quiz time, straight from the Potter Family Studios at Montpelier. I'm so excited. Doug, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, but you're boring me. Okay. We just talked to someone who knows all about these things, and she was listening to the show, and she said that you're boring and that your jokes are dad jokes.
I do have two kids, so I'll take that as a compliment.
Okay. I want you to come up with something better for next time. But in the meantime, who are you, sir, our contestant?
My name is Joe Francella, and I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
Baltimore, Maryland. What's the constitutional significance of Baltimore, Maryland? It's close to Annapolis.
It's close to Annapolis.
Annapolis was
where they had one of the first conventions when the Articles of Confederation wasn't going well.
Very, very good. The Annapolis Conference of 1786. That wasn't your question, so you get no prize, but I simply wanted to know that. Okay, tremendous. Doug, do you have a quiz question for Joe?
I thought you were going to talk about the Department of Justice consent decree, but you were looking for a more historic answer, right?
I was, because, I'm into history because I'm old.
Yeah. Okay, well, here's a little history. Joe, we're going to give you a question, and you're going to give you four choices. One of those likely to be true.
Okay, do I have to explain my thinking?
Yes.
Okay.
I want analysis.
Okay.
I don't simply want the answer, because that's boring.
Understood.
Okay.
Joe, what was the name of the first woman in the colonies or states to vote? What was the name of the first woman in the colonies or states to vote? Was it A, Betsy Ross, B, Sojourner Truth, C, Lydia Taft, or D, Susan B. Anthony?
Give us some of that analysis there.
Okay, well, I know it wasn't Betsy Ross, and I know it wasn't...
Wait, flag. Flag, no? She didn't, flag and wave the flag and vote?
Well, maybe symbolically, but I don't know if she cast a vote.
Okay. I just wanted to check that out. Okay, good.
Sojourner Truth, she was for women's rights and abolition, but I don't think she ever voted. And my... last two choices are Taft, and I'm going to go with Susan B. Anthony.
Susan B. Anthony rather than Taft. Why not Taft?
Because Susan B. Anthony is more associated with women's suffrage, I guess. I don't know. She comes to mind more. I guess I'm not getting my t-shirt.
You're giving things away here. You're nodding too much. You're used to doing these over the phone. Yeah. You're not used to the live studio, and you're sitting there smiling and nodding when he gives the right answer. That
I'm leading him astray.
Is that all you are?
I am. It's not Susan B. Anthony.
Oh,
Sorry. My gosh.
Who was it?
No, it is Lydia Taft.
Who was Lydia Taft?
Lydia Taft.
Other than the first woman to vote.
She was an 18th century woman in Massachusetts. This was back when Massachusetts was a colony. And she got a chance to vote in two municipal elections as a proxy for her son.
Oh, that's how she got in. She kind of bootstrapped it in because it wasn't really her vote. It was her son's vote.
That's right. So this is in Uxbridge, Massachusetts. Sorry, people in Massachusetts, if I mispronounced that. And what happens is she comes from a very rich family.
It's Uxbridge.
Uxbridge?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist.
She comes to a very rich family. The husband dies, and she, in essence, on two occasions that we know, casts a vote on behalf of her son, who is, I guess, a landowner because the property has moved to the son over her. It is likely that, of course, because they were rich landowners, they let this slide. And she, in fact, Lydia Taft, first woman ever to vote in the United States.
Okay.
Joe, do not feel bad about missing that question. I had no clue about that one. You've taught us something here today.
I just hope my girlfriend's not mad at me about it.
Well, girlfriends do get mad at us.
Yeah.
You know, we just have to take it. We have to be men. All right. Thanks, Joe. We appreciate your time. Yay. All right. And thank you, Doug.
Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to return to our discussion with David O. Stewart, an author, historian, a constitutional lawyer, who is one of the few lawyers to have actually defended an impeachment case before the United States Senate. There was actually a federal judge. His name was Walter Nixon. And David defended him in front of the Senate. In fact, before the break, he told us that entire story. And his case got appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. He lost. I'm sorry about that. Sorry, David. But he made some really remarkable arguments, and his discussion tells us how impeachments are handled in the modern era. But the reason we asked David on the show was because he's written a book that was recently lauded in the Wall Street Journal as being the very best book about impeachment. It's called Impeached, and it's about Andrew Johnson.
Johnson succeeded to the presidency when Lincoln was assassinated. It's just a few weeks, I guess a month into Lincoln's second term. And Johnson is something of an accident as vice president. Lincoln wanted a running mate who would appeal to more conservative, non-Republican voters. Lincoln, of course, was a Republican who had freed the slaves through the Emancipation Proclamation. He was going to get Republican votes. There was nowhere else for them to go, but he wanted to appeal to what were called war Democrats, who were Democrats who supported the North in the Civil War. And Johnson was the most prominent Democrat who had supported the war. He was then military governor of Tennessee. He had stayed in his seat as senator from Tennessee even when the southern states seceded. So Lincoln chose him for that reason. He didn't know him particularly well. One likes to think if he had known him better, he wouldn't have picked him. Johnson was a very smart man, self-educated, had never attended school a day in his life. But he had a very unpresidential makeup. He was an angry man. He bore grudges. His bodyguard described him as the best hater I ever knew. Huh. And he was a former slave owner who actually, his sympathies were all with the South, it turned out. He had started his presidential term making very vengeful statements about the South and really flipped by the end of his first year and became extraordinarily favorable to the Southern interests. There was...
Before we leave that, let's a couple of comments.
Sure.
First of all, one might wonder why Lincoln would choose such a man to be his running mate, but the election of 1864 was anything but a sure thing for Lincoln.
Yes, he feared being defeated, and he thought he needed to appeal to these non-classic Republican voters at the time.
Yeah, so it was an astute political
move. He even renamed his party. Mm-hmm. He renamed the Republican Party the Union Party for that election.
Just remarkable. Okay, so he made an astute, calculated political decision, as he often had to do throughout his career. So he gets Andrew Johnson. Of course, nobody ever chooses a vice president thinking that that person is necessarily going to become president. Nobody figures he's going to die, especially Lincoln at that point. Perhaps he was a relatively young man in his 50s. But he does die, and so Johnson becomes president. And what you just said there, is, I found striking, as he was making vengeful comments about the South early on. Did that spring from his experiences as military governor down in Tennessee, where he'd encountered some resistance?
I honestly think it sprang from his personality, that he simply was a guy who got angry. He did throughout his presidency.
Well,
and that was a moment when he was feeling angry after he had cooled off, after some people had whispered in his ear about what he really should be doing. He changed his tune quite dramatically. He had been talking about hanging the leaders of the Confederacy.
Wow.
And he ended up essentially trying to welcome them back into control of their state governments.
That is quite
a controversial thing.
It is, and it's such a 180 that people, I'm sure, have difficulty understanding how he could reverse himself that way. The only comment I can offer, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that he was from a very fractured part of the state of Tennessee, East Tennessee, which was not pro-Confederacy. It was not slavery was not very prominent, primarily because of topography. There were not large plantations. This is high rolling. I'm speaking from Tennessee, of course. That's where this radio show is based. It's high, rolling, mountainous country. There simply was not as much of a slave culture. There was not nearly as much support for slavery or for the Confederacy. And his opinions prior to the war reflected that. He was anti-secession, even if he was a slave owner himself. And so I think he must have just been wrestling with these things for a long time. But I guess I can't psychoanalyze him from a remove of well over 100 years. So other than that, I mean, nothing accounts for his 180-degree turn other than his acerbic personality and the fact that people were whispering in his ear?
Yeah, some people blame his Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, for persuading him to change.
But Seward was no Southerner.
He was a New Yorker, of course,
yeah.
But he was very gentle about the South. Even before the war, he basically tried to keep Lincoln from essentially staging the war going through with a confrontation down at Fort Sumter. So Seward was much more of a dove, and he very much thought, the war was over. Everybody should just join hands and, sing kumbaya. And many Northerners did not have that view. In any event, Johnson I think he did wrestle with some of this. He had a great detestation, a class feeling, and a resentment of the high figures of the South, the Confederacy, because he had come from nothing. He was a poor boy, what emerges in the fall is he sets up this system where the Southerners all have to come to him and essentially get his acknowledgement of their taking the oath to support the government, and then he essentially issues a personal pardon to them. And there were hundreds and hundreds and then thousands of rich Southerners who came and petitioned him. He spent days and days and days meeting with these people who would come and kiss up to him. And at the end of that process, suddenly he's become one of them.
Okay, let's unpack that.
So there's a personality capture that happens through that process.
That is a fascinating vignette, thinking of all these former Confederate leaders just standing in line outside the White House. But before we get there, let's just be clear that the Southerners had been disenfranchised because of their participation in the leading of the Confederacy. They wanted their voting rights back, and so they were seeking another thing that's been very much in the news lately, the presidential pardon from this. And he was
to have their rights restored, they had to get something from Johnson, and they had, you know, the 11 Southern states were not in the Union. They had removed themselves from the Union. They were not politically part of the federal government. So there was a process which became known as Reconstruction, of reconstructing their own state governments so they would not support slavery anymore, and that they would acknowledge the rights of the African Americans who had been enslaved. And they also had to reconstruct how they interacted with the federal government. And there are consequences when you go into rebellion for 4 years and kill hundreds of thousands of people. You
know? Indeed. Indeed.
There were a lot of people in the North who wanted to follow, didn't want these people back in the government for a long time.
Well, one can understand now why this was so controversial, because this war had just been fought and hundreds of thousands of people have died. And now you're allowing the very same people who led the rebellion to reestablish themselves as the leaders in the reconstructed South.
Yeah, I mean, when the first elections to Congress were held in the South, you know, they returned, a dozen Confederate generals as congressmen and senators. The former vice president of the Confederacy, Alexander Stevens, was elected senator from Georgia. And when they got to Washington, the Republicans who controlled Congress basically said, would not seat them, just what we went through with Adam Clayton Powell, telling that story, too. They sent them home. They said, we're not going to let you in this Congress. And that was the moment when Andrew Johnson essentially declared war on Congress. He thought Congress did not have the right to do that. And that was the fundamental power struggle that was going on. We live in a polarized time, and, you know, we have to deal with it. But that was a polarized time. That was the worst we've ever had.
So Congress is refusing even to seat these former Confederates who have been pardoned by Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson's extremely angry with Congress. And so then he does something that they consider to be an impeachable offense. What was that?
Well, they go back and forth on a bunch of legislation, Reconstruction Acts, civil rights bills, and, you know, Johnson vetoes them and they pass them over his veto the same day often, which they could do now because there were no Southerners in the Congress.
Right.
So it was dominated by Republicans. They had awesome majorities. And so they finally laid a trap for him, to be honest. And it was done by a congressman from Pennsylvania named Thaddeus Stevens, who was a tough, wily guy, very committed to Reconstruction and to helping African Americans and the freed slaves. And one of the big fights was over Johnson's cabinet and his senior officials and the leaders of the army, because many of those people were Lincoln people. Many of those people believed strongly in the cause of emancipation and equal rights, and Johnson didn't. So he wanted to get rid of them. The principal candidate for this was, of course, Edwin Stanton, who was the Secretary of War and a very polarizing figure all by himself. There's a great new biography of him, just came out by Walter Starr. And so Stevens, Congressman Stevens, who really was the leader in Congress at the time, wrote this statute called the Tenure of Office Act, which was adopted, which basically said the president cannot get rid of a senior official who has to be confirmed by the Senate unless the Senate concurs. And this statute addressed an amazing silence in the Constitution. The Constitution is very clear how the president appoints his senior officials. He appoints them and they're approved by the Senate. But it doesn't say anything about how you get rid of them. It's just silent. They goofed. They weren't thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So the first Congress dealt with this and decided that the president ought to have the freedom to get rid of whoever he wants, whenever he wants to. After all, they're running his executive branch or her executive branch. And if he can't get rid of them, then he or she can't run their government. Thaddeus Stevens in 1866 decides the heck with that. We're not going to do that anymore. Now it's going to be a mirror image. We're going to make it a symmetrical process. If you get appointed with Senate confirmation, you have to be removed with Senate confirmation. Johnson, of course, vetoed it. It was passed over his veto. He complied with it in getting rid of several senior officials, and the Senate confirmed his dismissal of those officials. But then he tried to get rid of Edwin Stanton, and the Senate refused to confirm it. And he stewed about that for a couple of months. And then finally, he just fired him and sent a new man over to take over and said, I have a new Secretary of War. And one of the entertaining parts of the story is that Secretary Stanton refused to leave his office.
he kind of barricaded himself in, didn't he?
Yeah, he just stayed there for 3 months. He's sent home for, you know, linen and food.
He literally did not leave his office for 3 months.
That's right. At the last couple of weeks, apparently, he started going out for dinner with his wife, and everybody would sort of realize that was okay. They were in the middle of the impeachment trial, and, you know, Stanton had made his point. But he was mostly there for 3 months. It was a crazy situation. We had one guy going to the cabinet meetings as Secretary of War, and we had the other guy was in the office with access to all the levers of power of the Secretary of War. We were very lucky that no foreign nation decided to invade us at the time. It would have been most confusing.
But I mean, there was military government in the South then, so he was actually issuing orders, and the generals were following Stanton's orders?
You know, they tried to finesse it because it was going to be awkward. So General Grant was the man in the middle, since he was still the leading general at the top of the army. So he issued all the orders and basically didn't consult either Secretary of War. And it got awkward because the commanders of the five different Reconstruction districts, as you say, the Northern troops were occupying the South. So you had military commanders of the five different regional districts. They had to report back through the Secretary of War and through the War Department. So there was I forget his name now. There was an administrative figure there who is widely viewed to have been very supple in his executive abilities, who simply just got most things managed without ever talking to Stanton, and the hard questions would get kicked over to Grant. It was a weird time.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris, and today I'm in the midst of a fascinating discussion with my buddy, a constitutional lawyer, a historian, an author. His name is David O. Stuart. And he's written a book about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. The book was actually written a number of years ago, but recently it was cited by the Wall Street Journal as the very best book to read on the subject of impeachment. After the break, we'll continue. Well, actually, we'll finish our discussion with David O. Stuart, and we might even ask him a little bit about current events. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with David O. Stuart, the author of Impeached, a book about the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. It turns out that there were many reasons that Congress impeached Johnson, but perhaps the precipitating cause was his firing, or his attempt to fire, the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, who simply refused for several weeks, several months actually, to leave his office. So you've got Stanton barricaded over there. You've got a new Secretary of War attending the cabinet meetings. You've got Andrew Johnson deliberately violating a law that he tried to veto and was overridden on. And so finally Congress says, okay, Mr. President, that's enough. This is an impeachable offense. And they draw up articles of impeachment.
Yeah, the House approved the articles of impeachment within 5 days.
And they went beyond this, too. There were a number of articles that I read some years ago, and a lot of them kind of involved this, but only tangentially, and they made reference to him being disrespectful and ridiculing Congress in speeches, et cetera, et cetera. There were about 10 of them, 10 articles?
Actually, there were 11. Mm-hmm. A bunch of them were related to the tenure of office issue. It was the 11th that actually was the one they voted on first, because it was what I would call a catch-all article. It sort of threw everything they didn't like about Andrew Johnson into one place. And some of it was that he was a jerk, mm-hmm. But some of it also was essentially that he was defeating the will of the nation in his opposition to essentially congressional enactments and his refusal to enforce the civil rights and Reconstruction laws. I don't like catch-all clauses, articles, because as a defense lawyer, they're very hard to defend. You're mm-hmm. sort of the one-armed paper hanger. You got to defend six different accusations at once. But I actually think that was the one, and so did the people who were doing it at the time, that was the one that had the most legs. That the Tenure of Office Act was sort of a put-up deal. Mm-hmm. And
let's just remind ourselves that the standard is that he's supposed to be impeached only for committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
And that's where the trouble starts.
Yeah, I mean, how could you even say any of this stuff?
That phrase is completely unclear.
Yeah, what does that mean?
Yeah, well, it comes from, you know, the 11th century in Britain, and the English have applied it through their history in different centuries in different ways. They beheaded people in impeachments. They did all sorts of stuff that we would not recognize. So that is, I found that old British history ultimately completely unuseful. And all you can really look at is that when senators see that language, and I'm being very practical here, this is what a practicing lawyer has to figure out, is what do they see? And they see the word crime, and they can't get past it. Mm-hmm. So they want to see a crime. And I really think that historically the term high crimes and misdemeanors, and the way it was used by the Constitutional Convention, it was intended to mean abuse of office. But
okay.
Senators do not see it that way. Senators see it as a crime. They need to see a crime.
Didn't Jerry Ford some years ago, when I think they were debating the potential impeachment of Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, didn't he say high crimes and misdemeanors are whatever the House says they are?
He did.
And I think that was probably, as flip as that sounds, it's probably accurate, isn't it?
Well, it is at one level, which is impeachment is an extreme act. It is one branch of government decapitating the other branch. And it is an act of power. And it is when you're, you know, when you're exercising power like that, you just need to do it however you can persuade enough people to vote for you that way. So in that sense, he's right. I don't think it's true, though, because I do think it means abuse of office. It can't actually be that we don't like this guy or he's doing things we don't like. It's that he is doing things that are unacceptable for any individual. It's not his policies. It's the way he is performing them. In Andrew Johnson's case, for example, Congress had enacted these laws that he did not support, and he was declining to enforce them in the South. He was removing those generals who tried to enforce them. I think that was impeachable. He was thwarting the will of the people. He was thwarting the Constitution. I don't think a president can do that. It can be allowed to do that.
And he almost got impeached, didn't he? I mean, excuse me, he almost got convicted and removed.
He almost did.
It came down to a single vote, didn't it?
It did. It did.
And you don't like that result.
I thought there were grounds to remove him. Mm-hmm. I was particularly distressed as a writer of history to discover that this fellow who was the key vote, a fellow named Edmund Ross from Kansas, whom we have no other reason to remember, is often given the credit for saving Johnson. Indeed, when President Kennedy, who was then a senator, wrote his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Profiles in Courage. He anointed Ross's vote as perhaps the most courageous act in American history, which is appalling because I am persuaded, based on considerable evidence, that Ross was bribed to vote for Johnson.
That's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah. It was a dirty time in American politics. People got bribed to do a lot of things. Secretary of State Seward was something of a master at arranging such things. He and the Postmaster General and the Secretary of the Treasury, Hugh McCulloch, got together and they put together a slush fund to pay the whatever the freight would require. And there were a lot of conversations recorded, some recorded in the notes of the President's Chief of Staff, about buying senators' votes.
Oh, my.
Ross himself actually hung out with perhaps the juiciest patronage people in the Johnson administration. And within a week of his vote, he got Johnson to appoint his candidate to be head of the Internal Revenue Service, to a couple of others, Indian agents in Kansas. I mean, it was, as I read the evidence, was a deal. And Ross was cashing in.
Just remarkable. Okay, so our first impeached president was not actually convicted and removed. Fascinating tale, fascinating book. People should read it. No question about that. You should go out and buy it. Now, the question I have for you now, and let's not get overly political with this. Let's try to be as objective as we can and as lawyerly as we can. Impeachment, as you say, is in the air these days. People, especially those who are opposed to our current president, are calling for his impeachment and cite a number of different grounds that they think that the Congress could use to impeach him. Now, politically speaking, with Republican majorities in both the House and Senate, that's very unlikely at this point. But let's just confine ourselves to the constitutional question. Do you think that any of the things that Mr. Trump has done would actually rise to the level of being an abuse of power, as you say, that would be impeachable offenses?
I don't think so, just personally from what I know about what he's been doing. Frankly, it is not impeachable to be infuriating to a large portion of the electorate. It is not impeachable to, you know, act in a way that people find humiliating. It does have to involve something he's done by my lights that would be viewed as an abuse of his office. You could get there, possibly with some things that are in the air these days, but I don't think we're there. You know, the allegations about, obstruction of justice in connection with the Russia investigation. If there's more there, well, that certainly could be. With Richard Nixon, Congress was definitely moving towards impeachment at the time of his resignation, and that was essentially for obstruction of justice.
Right, smoking gun, a recording, right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but you're saying there's not enough evidence for that now. Well, one of the more recent events that I've heard people use as a basis for calling for impeachment is his pardon of Sheriff Arpaio out in Arizona. And the argument goes something like this, that, yes, the president has pardon power. Yes, that at least when you look at the text, there's no limit that's placed upon it. However, subsequent enactments like the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment would, in some sense, supersede that because there are later legislative enactments. It might very well then be unconstitutional to pardon somebody, as in the case of Sheriff Arpaio, for having disregarded a federal court order or being held in criminal contempt for that, because that is the vehicle through which the national government enforces constitutional rights, and that the president, in pardoning Sheriff Arpaio, has undercut the ability of the government to protect people's constitutional rights. That, you know, amounts to an abuse of power. That's the argument that I've been hearing.
Yeah, I think it's clever. But, you know, what if the sheriff had been convicted after a jury trial of denying people civil rights, which, you know, is not inconceivable based on the contempt order? Mm-hmm. That's a statute that was authorized by the 14th Amendment, which was enacted after the pardon power. I don't think the president's power to pardon such a conviction is really subject to question.
If I can restate what you just said, is pretty much any time a president pardons somebody, he is arguably undercutting the relief that would otherwise flow to the victims of that crime.
He is, absolutely.
And so basically—
undermining the rule of law at some level, you bet.
So this
is— The law is spoken in those cases.
So this is no different from any other pardon?
You know, it's provocative, which it was intended to be, I think. It's certainly premature, the legal process, the appeal of the conviction had not proceeded. So I think it was, it was ill-considered in several ways. Is it an impeachable offense? Not to me.
So we're just not there yet, is what you're saying, but it's quite possible, depending upon what surfaces in the future, that there will come a point where Congress could, if it wanted to, proceed and impeach and convict the president.
Yeah, I mean, it's always possible. We have some things floating around now that if they were ever to ripen and become more clear, you know, the emoluments clause issues with his personal interests, if something were to become clear about that. I mean, he's it's a phrase we used to use in criminal side of my practice, which was, some people are just accident prone. And, this guy is a little accident prone. He can be a little reckless even.
Okay.
So
last question, then.
Things could happen.
What advice do you have for the president to avoid impeachment? If he's not there yet, what should he do to avoid impeachment?
Oh, heavens. I would not presume to advise this president. I don't think he listens to lawyers.
Well, David O. Stewart, thank you so very much for sharing this with us. And once again, what's the name of the book that the Wall Street Journal so recently praised as the very best book on impeachment out there?
Impeach: The Trial of President Andrew Johnson and the Fight for Lincoln's Legacy.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my buddy, David O. Stewart, for telling us all about not just the impeachment of Andrew Johnson, but about impeachment generally. What a fascinating and timely subject. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.